Right, Steve, have you deleted everything we've ever said about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership?
Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty sure I've gotten rid of it, and I've burnt the hard drives as well.
Right, everything we said about how rubbish the campaign was?
Yep, it's all gone.
Every time we said that we should fire Seamus Milne out of a cannon?
Yep.
It's all there.
It's all gone. It's all been deleted. It's all been set fire. No one will ever know we ever doubted them.
Fantastic. Right, let's go with this. So, welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that never doubted Jeremy Corbyn's electoral strategy.
Never. Not once.
Not once. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and I'm here with three of the four people who are discussing Theresa May's decision to call a snap election to strengthen her hand when negotiating Brexit. Now, obviously, it's too early to tell if her hand has been strengthened, but first impressions aren't good. Now, with me is a man who left the bunker 3 weeks ago to forage for food and has come back with some humble pie for us to eat. It's Councillor John Cotton.
And those words are very nourishing every time I have to chow down on them.
We also have the chair of Birmingham Fabians, the great clunking fist of Luke John Davis.
Who is still unrepentant.
And we also have my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
This is a hotly anticipated podcast. We've had at least six, I think, people tweet us or message us or kind of daub messages on walls saying that they were wondering how we would try and make sense of this election campaign.
Yes. All of our mothers have been interested in this podcast.
That's the mother of all podcasts. And we're going to talk about the result, and we're going to talk about how it came about and what the implications are. Now, perhaps one thing that we didn't talk about 4 weeks ago, because essentially the poll situations were so laughably bad for Labour and we were all trying to avoid saying that we thought we'd get about 12 seats and get completely humiliated.
I actually said it. So, you know, yeah, I look stupid.
That's
now.
True. Well, some of us kept the message discipline. Some of us went through 4 weeks of podcasting without repeating the Tory attack lines.
Yeah, it wasn't me.
It wasn't Corey either.
But one rule of politics maybe is don't call a snap election. If you've already ruled it out, but also so soon after another general election, because generally people don't like voting twice. I mean, John, do you think there are any historical parallels with, say, 1923 or 1970 when prime ministers have tried to call snap elections in the past?
I've been racking my brains trying to think of when a snap election actually worked. And the only one I can think of was in 66 when Wilson went, I think about 18 months after winning a very, very small majority. Other than that, you go back to 1923, Baldwin lost his majority, calling a snap election. There was what Heath did in 74, going early, and again, saw his majority wiped out when he asked the question, who governs? And they said, not you, mate. It seems that history has repeated itself. So the memo to any incoming prime minister should be, don't call a snap election.
Yeah, actually, I think there's newfound respect for Gordon Brown's decision not to call a snap election.
His problem wasn't not calling the snap election, it was allowing the speculation to just continue and build until it was there. I think if he had repeatedly denied that it was going to be one in the way May did, and then not called one, he'd have been fine.
It has quite spectacularly backfired, hasn't it? Because I think they didn't really think their campaign through, did they? If they're going to make their campaign about strong and stable leadership, and now the campaign's over, we can actually go through the attack lines. If you're going to make it about leadership, you actually need to turn up to the debates. Mm. You actually do need to prove that you are a leader.
A strong and stable leader who ran away from Woman's Hour. I mean,
just the entirety of Theresa May's performance during the campaign was incredibly poor. Not really taking any real interviews, even with like local news outlets and things. Mm. There were, you know, local papers which basically put out interviews with her where she said nothing. They had no leading line off of the interview at all, which is impressive when you're the Prime Minister, because normally you can at least say, this is what we want to do in government. Mm. And if she's managed to even get not even say that in a bog standard interview, that's terrible. Well,
I think it's pretty staggering that I can't recall another senior politician I've seen who looks so deeply uncomfortable having to engage with the electorate. Poor old Gordon Brown used to get a bit of a pounding over how he came across, but you know, this was in a completely different league. You're right. You know, wouldn't speak to engage with voters, didn't turn up to debates. This kind of speak your weight machine approach to parroting out lines again and again without answering any questions,
which we see again actually in her speech outside Downing Street yesterday.
Yes, absolutely.
which was the same speech she would have given had she won the majority of 50 or 60.
It was the biggest delusional thing I've seen in
nothing here to see. Move along now.
And not just with the electorate, but also with broadcast interviews as well. I mean, her interview with Andrew Neil, I think, must be the worst interview a sitting prime minister has ever given to a broadcast media. Apparently there was one in the 19th century where Lord North actually did defecate himself while being interviewed for the Manchester Guardian. But apart from that, I can't really think of a worse example.
It was the shock of doing the interview in the 19th century when he died in 1792. Fact fans.
John remembers the funeral.
But the thing is, I've got some friends who are Tory party members and Tory party activists. And, yeah, I know, shocking.
Never missed this before?
I know.
That's not on the security clearance.
Oh, no, do I need to leave the bunker? But no, I've got friends who are Conservative Party members and activists, and they went along, as you do, to the various rallies and events during the general election. Theresa May turned up in Birmingham just before polling day, did a small little speech, and you know my friends that were there were not particularly positive about it. They quite like May in general. The way that she held herself, she didn't even answer their questions. It was always, again, back to those same parroted lines. And what was apparently quite interesting was that the entirety of the time that she was there, her husband was always in eyesight of her. It's like she is clearly not someone who's very comfortable with the actual campaigning process itself, which is fine. I can totally understand that. I know I've met a number of politicians who aren't. You don't necessarily enjoy it in the way that Jeremy Corbyn does or some other MPs do, but they recognise it as a part of the job and they cope with it. It looks like Theresa May can't actually cope with it very well, which is why I think maybe that her husband was actually following her around almost as a kind of a safety blanket of sorts, someone there to constantly remind that there's somebody there that she can fall back on and it's also
probably, I mean, was it Durham she lost? So she had that campaign before she was an MP where essentially she knew from the start she was going to lose. Then she's had a safe seat where she's, you know, essentially going around shaking hands, kissing babies.
At
the same time. Well, don't get them mixed up. Don't kiss hands and then shake the babies, you get into trouble. When really has she been actually challenged in a campaign? Because the leadership campaign, she gave a speech and then suddenly she'd won without anybody really
asking
a question of her. Instead of campaigning, she runs through wheat fields, from what I can gather, and which does explain crop circles. It's when she U-turns.
Yeah, and apparently she refused to do hustings in 92, well, when she was first a campaigner, because she didn't like them and found them very nerve-wracking. Is she toast, LJ?
Yes. Next question.
Is David Davis going to be Prime Minister?
Oh, God. No. I mean, look, I think...
Seal the bunker.
The Conservatives are not... Well, they're ruthless, aren't they? I mean, the Conservatives are absolutely ruthless. They will not allow another campaign of this low standard, right? She has lost the unlosable elections, right? And okay, she's still Prime Minister. She's got as long as it takes them to line someone else up.
And the media's turned on her, I think, as well, hasn't it? When you see the headlines of the front pages today, and it's like May's had her chips, and they've got the picture of Theresa May eating chips, which looks very, very awkward. It's like the Ed Miliband moment.
Yeah.
It looks bad.
The right-wing press has started to realise how little bite it's got left.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing I found was, obviously, when I went into work on the day after polling day, I was just chatting to my work colleagues about the election and the things, and so many of them, even ones who were kind of Cameroonian conservatives and were basically like, for the most part, would happily have voted conservative under David Cameron, really didn't like Theresa May, but they would happily vote Tory and have done previously, were basically saying the way that the Sun, the Mail, the Express had treated Corbyn, they literally used the words smear campaign to me. And I genuinely think that their influence seems to have peaked and is looking to drop off a little bit.
I think it's part of that. I think it's also partly that there's two other things to think about that. First of all is, for a huge number of young people who obviously turned out in numbers, they don't remember the IRA. It doesn't really mean anything to them in terms of the kind of... They don't have the same memories of it that some of the older generation does. Also, Britain loves an underdog for the next one. It felt so over the... I mean, even I was sitting there going, oh, come on. It felt so over the top that it just felt like it couldn't possibly be true because it was just so...
And I think it's also Corbyn then goes on the One Show, talks about his hobby of photographing manhole covers and gives them homemade jam.
In Corbynical mode.
It's hard to really paint someone who collects pictures of manhole covers as this kind of evil, seditious terrorist sympathiser.
It's also that they were trying to portray him at exactly the same time as weak and naive this horrifically dangerous terrorist. And those aren't two pictures that you can line up.
Yeah, they're more or less mutually exclusive. They needed to stick to one and just go with it. And again, this is the interesting thing about so much of the Tory campaign is, actually looking back from what you've seen, was there wasn't, as much as we were kind of going, oh, they're going strong and stable, strong and stable, strong and stable, coalition of chaos and all that time and time again. The actual underlying message around Corbyn, who was forming a core part of their campaigning activity in terms of their social media spend and their content production with the videos and things like that, was very, very mixed. It was split between those two different things, one of which is just trying to portray him as incompetent, the other almost as this evil mastermind who's going to destroy Britain. Those two things don't go together, and therefore people end up seeing a mixed message of him, and therefore when they see two conflicting messages, they just go, well, they're both clearly wrong.
Yeah. The other thing I think that you've got, Corbyn only could go up, right? Because all this stuff about the IRA and everything else had come out in the 2 years beforehand. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the people who were planning to vote Labour at the start of this campaign had already factored it in and didn't care. So he only had up to go in terms of the numbers and that.
I think there are the two things that come out of me. One is this danger that we all fall prey to, of viewing politics through the prism of the politics through which we grew up. So, you know, I tend to refer straight back to the 80s and particularly the 90s, and the whole assumption that you can only win from a place that's essentially the centre ground, and, you know, build your appeal out from there.
I remember the centre ground.
The centre ground, yeah. The radical centre ground. So I think there's a danger that you kind of view it through that prism, and clearly something else has been happening in terms of the fundamental shift in which I'm not sure I fully understand yet. And then the other thing I think that's really striking about that message that the Tories were fighting on and the inconsistency is there's kind of this, one hand you've got the Linton Crosby playbook playing out around, let's just go for them, throw all the crap that we can at the other side. And then clearly the other stuff that was going on around not being clear on what your own message is and what your own policy prospectus is. And I think this shows the degree of chaos there was. Ironically, the coalition of chaos was sat down in Street and Central Office, and that's where they've ended up in that position that they have.
I think what's interesting is with the 2015, to some extent the 2010 campaign as well, although it was, I mean, and the 2015 wasn't really seen as a great campaign until it turned out that it gave them the Tories a majority, but although there was this there were the repeating of the attack lines, this long-term economic plan, this coalition of chaos again. There was a very clear conception, I think, of who Cameron and Osborne wanted to target to get out to vote and what they were going to give them in return for that vote. So that's why you have the triple lock on pensions. Mm-hmm. It's why you have the winter fuel allowance for pensioners, because that's a way of getting them out and on your side. Now, Labour had that in its manifesto. Now, we talked before in our manifesto podcast, we'll probably talk in our subsequent podcast on Labour, about how Labour's becoming the party seemingly of the professional middle class, and that's why they were about trying to bring in a scrapping tuition fees rather than freezing benefit cuts. However, there's a clear group of people who were going to vote Labour because of the free stuff that was in the manifesto. Now, there's a nice quote from a Tory aide, I think, who said that essentially the Tory manifesto said they were going to maim small animals, take away people's homes and make them freeze. And it wasn't really obvious what positive reason you would vote Tory apart from to stop Jeremy Corbyn being number 10. And I think it's a big problem that, again, I think everyone overestimated because Corbyn, but that disappeared in over the four weeks of the election campaign.
Although, you know, it still gave them 60 seats more than Labour. Nearly.
But again, that boils down to the generational divide. And again, this is, we'll discuss this more in the podcast next week, I think. There's just such a big gap now between the generations, where the older generations, the ones who do remember the IRA, who do take a much more stringent view on the economy and deficits and things like that, are at the moment not going to touch Labour with a barge pole because it's led by Corbyn. I mean, his ratings over the course of the campaign have gone up, and they have actually gone up amongst all of the different demographics. But still, there's just a giant, giant gap between Labour and the Conservatives, of people who are 55 and above for the most part. The Tories still have a bedrock and a higher base than Labour do, because I think at the moment what we're seeing is the new baseline for both Labour and the Tories, at least for the short term. Things given the environment we're in, could change rapidly. But it's very difficult to see how Labour can go anywhere without winning over older voters, and it's very difficult to see how the Tories can go anywhere without winning over younger voters.
And we can talk about that probably more in our podcast out in the next few days. And I think a good example of that generational divide was the question time that May and Corbyn did in York. And you could tell there that there was a section of the audience of old, angry white men who basically did not... They were shouting at Corbyn for refusing to nuke various foreign countries. And then there was a younger lady in the audience who said, well, I just can't believe that the people in this audience are excited by wanting to murder millions of people. And I think it's that divide, as you say, John, it's the politics we grew up in. It's that Cold War Britain where people believe in that nuclear deterrent, think Britain needs that nuclear deterrent, and a younger generation who don't see the need for there to be that sort of deterrent.
I think the other thing with the older generation in terms of the deterrent is it's still seen as the one thing we've got left that makes Britain a great power. Your older generation, your ones who sort of fought in the Second World War or immediately afterwards, when they grew up, you know, we're talking about sort of the politics of when you grew up, it's national decline, and that's the story they view things through. And they see the remote scrapping of nuclear weapons as a symptom of British national decline, not as a kind of, you know, let's all be nice to each other kind of thing. It's there's a sort of a misunderstanding between the two sides as to what each other means. One side is expressing, I don't like the fact that my country is lesser than it was when I was young. And the other side is expressing, you know, let's all be friends.
The interesting thing about this generational split is that it's effectively very, very similar in a lot of ways to what in the US is dubbed the culture wars. You know, just the complete difference between Democrats and Republicans on things like abortion, birth control, guns, those sorts of things. And we're starting to see that for the first time, I think, really, in the UK over here, over these sorts of issues, because they are not compatible. You cannot compromise on these sorts of issues. You're either okay with Britain having nukes and being prepared to fire them, or you are not. There is no way to triangulate these sorts of issues, which is why I think both Labour and the Tories have their work cut out for them. Is how do you appeal to these people when there's no middle ground necessarily? Because we like to talk about the centre ground in terms of politics, and in terms of this is where normally elections are won, but on a number of these issues there isn't necessarily a centre ground. You're either for it or you're against it.
If you do have an idea, do send your CV to Theresa May, care of number 10.
I think the other thing to think actually is that what Corbyn is doing is trying to put together the Obama coalition, right? You know, young graduates, highly educated people, and ethnic minority communities. The trouble with that is we've seen what happens when the white working class abandons that.
I think actually there's coalition. An interesting Stephen Bush article a few weeks ago on that point, who says that Labour were trying to put together the coalition Obama had. The demographics are more like the America of the 1970s. So as you say, that's not enough for a majority. Yeah. We need to win over Tory voters. Again, that's our next podcast. Speaking of culture wars and abortion, brings us nicely to the Democratic Unionist Party.
The political wing of the 17th century.
The moderating influence on this Tory government.
For those of you who are worried that the DUP is going to be the tail wagging the Tory dog, the moderating influence is going to be the Scottish Tories, right? Because Theresa May is trying to please the DUP with 13 MPs who take their orders from an LGBTQ young woman who is engaged to an Irish Catholic woman who campaigned for equal marriage in Northern Ireland. How do you get those... Again, you're talking about culture wars. How do you get those two wings? And she needs them both to back her. So I don't... You know, I'm not saying that it's going to be quick, but I think what might actually end up bringing down Theresa May is trying to get Scottish Tories and the DUP on the same page.
I think this is going to be the interesting thing about the DUP is what they actually lay out their lines on, because there are a number of things which, to be quite honest, you know, they could easily do. And you know, Theresa May will probably say, yep, that's absolutely fine. We'll find the money for extra infrastructure spending in Northern Ireland.
There are going to be so many nice roads built in Northern Ireland over the next 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. But basically bungs to Northern Ireland, which will improve things over there. Even if it's not necessarily needed. So you've got those sorts of demands, which will almost certainly be in there, but probably won't actually receive that much coverage. Mm-hmm. But what we might see, and there seems to be starts of a few bits and pieces here leaking through, was some discussions about whether or not there would be votes on limiting abortion or kind of cutting back the dates where abortions could be acquired. The reality is, any sorts of votes like that would almost always certainly be free votes.
yep.
in any way. And I doubt that there is the numbers in Parliament to actually achieve those things anyway. So in many ways, those sorts of, again, cultural issues are probably pointless. There's not actually, the DUP aren't going to change British law on these issues. In terms of them wagging, being a tail that wags the dog, I don't really see it being too much of an issue.
There's an interesting political tension that potentially comes out of that, because if this becomes about basically pork barrel politics and spending lots of money to keep the DUP sweet, in the same context of, you know, local government budgets, other budget, public sector spending, the NHS being under pressure on the mainland, a clever opposition can make a lot of hay with that.
You also got the issue where, you know, the laws that do not affect Northern Ireland are being passed by the Northern Irish. I mean, it's, the West Lothian question is kind of being reared as sort of the question. Was the East Londonderry question, you know, which is, she does have a majority under English votes for English laws still.
But there are an awful lot of the sorts of policies that she's looking to bring in, such as grammar schools. I doubt we're going to have a free vote on fox hunting anymore. But even if they did, there's enough of the Conservative Party in England that, and that's before we even touch Scotland, and Ruth Davidson's segment of the Scottish Tories. There are enough of them which are going to just rebel on a number of these issues, because actually the Conservative Party is a lot more socially progressive than it used to be. We disagree with them on an awful lot, but they have come a very long way. Even Theresa May has come a very long way on a number of these issues. Like her record on LGBT rights, for instance, is an example. She's much less anti than she used to be. So it's going to be quite interesting to see how all of these dynamics play out for them.
My big worry is what this means for the peace process and the fact that we've still got Stormont suspended at the moment, the fact that we've now got the government of the country dependent upon the support of one particular party, and a unionist party, the implications that has for being able to get the assembly up and running again, to get power sharing up and running again, that really worries me, because there's the huge gains that we've made over the last 20 years. You know, go back to the podcast when we're talking about 20 years since the new Labour government. The possibility that might be undermined by this is something that should be troubling everybody.
And this is especially true when you consider that, I mean, most people don't pay that much attention to Northern Irish politics. That's obviously something that I think is going to change across the short term, at least. You know, the DUP aren't necessarily in that healthy a state at the moment in terms of Irish politics.
They're only just out of this Cash for Ash scandal.
Exactly. They're in the middle of a scandal. They lost seats at the last Stormont elections. You know, their leadership has the potential to be trying to turn this situation into a way to boost their core vote, get their people out there, which has the potential to be disastrous for the peace process.
So what's Cash for Ash? Is that relating to the 90s indie band of the same name?
The DUP introduced a scheme where they would pay farmers to use biofuels, as I understand it, and then essentially it turned out that it was making money for farmers by basically buying wood chips and burning them was a way for them to actually make money, because they were being paid more to burn them than it cost to buy them.
Yeah, essentially the idea was that you'd take the the waste from your crops and things like that, you'd burn them, turn it into energy which could be fed back into the national grid, and as part of that, you know, there'd be some money paid over to you for actually doing that. It's a way to try and generate power in a slightly more sustainable way.
It's not a bad idea. I mean,
It's basic cogeneration, which I happen to know a lot about because one of my clients sells these systems for a living. As it turns out, the government, the Northern Irish Assembly, hadn't really thought things through. They set the prices too high for what they were paying people, and enough of farmers had realised this where they just went and bought a load of wood chips, started burning them, and they were making a profit off of it.
Makes the common agricultural policy look like sensible.
And this is why the farmers were upset that Theresa May was running through the fields outside.
Yes,
fields of wood chips.
Running through the fields of Athenry.
Yeah. I suppose it's interesting, maybe the Brexit implications. One of the most terrifyingly depressing things I've seen on my Twitter and Facebook feeds over the last couple of days is a DUP leaflet from 1975. I don't know if you've seen this, about the first European referendum. And it says, "A vote for the common market is a vote for ecumenicalism, Rome, dictatorship and Antichrist." So,
sounds like a good night out to me.
Hopefully, they've moved on since 1975.
I don't think they have.
Well, here's the thing. Recently, there were some scandals where I think one of their ministers or something had to stand down from their role because they effectively said that the only thing that was worse than child abuse was being gay. That they have a whole host of figures within their party who, to be honest, make UKIP look sane. There's a I've started calling them the Northern Irish version of the GOP, because they are that kind of socially conservative. They're not even where UKIP are. They're beyond that because of the situation they find themselves in, where they've just kind of
beyond UKIP in terms of radical views, seats, votes, influence,
everything.
Does it potentially, especially with Brexit and the Irish border? Do you think, obviously that's something that Theresa May has said she wants to get sorted quickly. It's a good job we just haven't spent 3 months after triggering Article 50 on general election, and then we'll have another one in a year.
It's also, right, you're going to be negotiating that border with the Irish government.
Who aren't fans of the DUP.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're not exactly huge fans of the DUP.
I mean, this is one of the areas where maybe, just maybe, the DUP could be a positive influence, is that they admit and they know that they can't have a hard border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, that they know that's just not really feasible. But so it's possible that, given their stance and their knowledge and the history over there, is they may potentially take Theresa May aside and go, look, we would much rather be, you know, entirely free of Europe and outside the single market like you, yada, yada, yada. But our situation as such means that we need to have this border not be there. In which case, if the only way we can do that is with freedom of movement, then let's have freedom of movement. That could be a potential thing, but it really does depend on them and how hardline the DUP are going to be. That's what we don't know yet.
Thanks to everyone who's listened in. Thanks to everyone who's shared us on Facebook or on Twitter. Thanks to all those of you who've left positive reviews as well. We've got loads of 5-star reviews, which is great. If you can keep them coming, it does help people discover the show. And literally thousands of you have listened to our general election coverage. So thank you very much. I mean, after our predictions episode, you must be wondering why you bothered. But we'll have new podcasts, new projects coming out over the next few weeks. I think Elge and I are going to do a Birmingham Fabies one, which will probably just be us laughing hysterically in an empty, darkened room. And they'll be coming out over the next few weeks, next few months. Our theme tune is Pookie Good Times by Dave Depper. That's on freemusicarchive.org. And our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. I'm at Paperback Writer.
I'm at Centre Radical.
I'm at Councillor John Cotton.
And I'm LJ Davies 87, Davies with an E.
We'll be back probably in the week talking about the Labour campaign. Speak to you then.
Sort of family history of IRA and so on. So, but
do you want to rephrase that?
Yeah, I do. Actually,
you make it sound like you were a member.
So yeah. So I mean,
the DUP in government, LJ. I couldn't find you.
I thought it was the Fabians, not Sinn Féin. You were the
it's Sinn Fabians with a cover.
Somebody ring regional office. Make it stop.
This has to be edited.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. This happens quite a lot.